Blade upon publication. However, it grants further freedom to police to record ordinary citizens without their consent. Anyone found guilty of infringement could face a fine of up to €45,000 and 12 months in jail. Supporters of the bill say it protects officers and their families and that it does not undermine freedom. However, those claims have failed to convince others, as the legislation has faced a barrage of condemnations and outrage from a wide range of people and organizations. Opponents say the legislation erodes freedom of press. On Wednesday, clashes broke out between security forces and demonstrators protesting the bill in the city of Bordeaux. Thousands of people also rallied across the country, including the capital, Paris, against the proposed legislation.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous, because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Amnesty International has lashed out at Paris for persisting with the bill, saying it sends a worrying message. The European Union has also expressed concern, saying Paris needs to ensure that journalists be able to work freely and in full security. The bloc has warned that it will examine the law to make sure it's in line with EU policies. In today's digital world, it's hard to imagine what would happen if people were stripped of the right to film potential injustices. In May, the publication of a video showing US police brutality against a black man sparked weeks of protests. The officer who killed the unarmed man was charged with second-degree murder and later discharged. Such a brutal incident may have gone unheard if it weren't for a passerby to record it on his mobile phone. The new French law takes away from people their minimal protection against police brutality, their freedom to film violence.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, political analyst and member of the Solidarity and Progress Party, Sébastien Perrimoni, joins us from Paris. We also have journalist and political analyst, Geoffroy Coleman, who also joins us from Paris. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, if I may, Sébastien Perrimoni. Tell us why you think this case is deemed controversial and, as it has been described, a violation of press freedom.
Yes, it's not only the violation of the press freedom, you know. I see that France, which are known as a champion of free speech and of human rights, is now showing a new face. And this face is the face of repression and censorship. So it's a very bad news, not only for the press, but also for the people, as the woman was saying in the demonstration. Because, as you know, we have been a champion, yes, in a freedom of speech and a freedom of press, as we have seen recently with the Mahomet caricature, you know, and the right to blaspheme, as we say in France. So even, you know, what is very strong to understand, that even all the editorial board of the major French channel and the major newspaper, BFM TV, TF1, Le Figaro, Libération, CNews, all the important newspaper and TV channels say that they are against, and they made a publication saying that they are against this Article 24 of the legislation, because it will prohibit them, you know, to cover finally the brutality that is going on around France. So we had the law in France. The law is from 1881, which is the law of freedom of speech and freedom of press. And now we are entering now in 2020, so almost 120 years later, in a new period of censorship and repression and reduction of our liberty.
Okay.
Which is very dangerous.
We're going to expand on that a little bit more, but Joao Coleman, let me ask you this. I mean, to get down to some of the nitty-gritty of this, it is said that this would limit the right to film or photograph on-duty police officers. Now, looking at that, doesn't that pave the way for officers to commit crimes and break the law while being immune to prosecution?
Of course. Yes, of course. I mean, the current restrictions on civil liberties, of course, are technically illegal. We have the right to assembly and the right to walk around and go about our work and about our business without being hassled by police. These are extreme measures which are being imposed, not just in France, but throughout Europe. And they are part of a transition towards a different type of society. The type of society they want to transition towards is a technocracy. And in a technocracy, the individual has no more civil liberties, and he's under 24-hour surveillance by cameras. We already have cameras everywhere in Europe, in every city. And they fear very much that the people will revolt. The restrictions on restaurants, bars, small businesses that have occurred again in the second lockdown mean that an entire class, essentially the middle class, is now becoming bankrupt. And an entire, the motor of the French economy, the motor of every economy in the world is the middle class, small businesses. They are being destroyed. They fear a social revolt. And of course, they know that if they don't give full powers to the police to repress that using whatever means necessary, the people will film them. And of course, that will go into social media. And so they're also trying to crack down on social media. They want to ban social media effectively and make it impossible for people to open up accounts on social media as well. So we're going into a new period of totalitarian control, essentially. And this is what the lockdowns are about. The lockdowns are completely useless in terms of protecting lives. You only have to look at Sweden to see that there's absolutely no impact on people's health. It's detrimental to people's health, mental and physical. It has nothing to do with public health. It is basically a transition to a new society, and that society is a technocracy. And that's very clear if you look at the global picture, if you look at the plans of Davos and the Great Reset. It's very clear if you read Klaus Schwab's book, for example, his recent book, that the kind of society they want is a society where there would be essentially no more society. It would be a technocracy where people, everything would be online. Of course, everything would be under surveillance. I mean, this is where we're at right now. So they fear also in France the consequences of the wide diffusion of a documentary recently, which got 6 million views and was seen by many, many people. They fear, you can hear them on the media talking about this all the time, the danger of conspiracy theories, the danger of thinking that there might be a conspiracy behind the lockdown. And of course, they sense that there will be a major social revolt, and probably a lot worse than the recent Gilets Jaunes. So remember, you had a massive rebellion against the state for over a year in France with the Yellow Vest movement that was repressed brutally by the police. And I think that they want to be able to repress the next rebellion with even further measures. So I think that's essentially what this is about.
Well, Sebastian, I'm hearing words like repression, totalitarianism, technocracy, social media restrictions, revolt. I mean, isn't France supposed to be a flag bearer of freedom after all? As the French slogan or motto is liberté, égalité, fraternité, French for liberty, equality, and fraternity. So I'm looking at the word liberty now being downgraded, is because that's what people are talking about, the French, in this respect. Is this the case, that this is being endangered?
It's not in danger if we fight. You know, I'm working with Jacques Cheminade, who was three-time candidate for the presidential election in France, and he has denounced for years, since the 1980s, the imposition of what he called a financial fascism. So it's true that if we want to maintain this financial fascism in the world, because we have to impose austerity, you need dictatorial power. So we have done that in South America, we have done that, I mean the West have done that in Africa, pushing and putting in place dictatorial power to impose its austerity policy. So now is the turn of Europe. So of course, if we accept, because we have to fight for this liberty and we have to fight for this fraternity, if we fight, we can save it. But it's true that if they want to go on with this financial austerity, this financial fascism, they will have to impose more stronger laws, you know, as the one we are seeing today, to control the revolt. Because as the other person mentioned, you know, since 2 years now we have the Yellow Vest in France, so it's 2 years of demonstration. And from the beginning, you know, the confrontational approach of the government, they decide to have this confrontational approach, I mean repression in the street, was above all to dissuade people and the population to take part at this demonstration. Because at the beginning of the Yellow Vest, if you remember, we have thousands of people in the street saying, we don't want the privatization of our country, we don't want austerity, We need to have food at the end of the month, so it's not possible anymore. So now we are angry and we want to change the system. So of course you have a revolt against this system, and we are fighting with Jacques Cheminade and Solidarité Progrès, with other countries in the world, fighting to change, to have this new Bretton Woods system, a new financial architecture, because, and it's true, what Emmanuel Barroso was calling the European Union, you know, a non-imperial empire, as he was saying, which is a supranational institution imposing austerity on people. So the people don't want that anymore. They are fighting for that. And I think the question of the commentary was mentioned is quite dangerous, because, of course, half of the documentary is very interesting against the criminal responsibility of the government. But the other half is pushing people, you know, in irrationality and going after, you know, things which are not the real cause of the problem, which is the financial system and this financial oligarchy. So we have to focus, as the Yellow Vest was doing at the beginning, to go back to the monetary sovereignty of our country with a national banking system, with the Glass-Steagall, which means the separation of the bank in France, and of course the possibility to have our own credit system to reinvest in infrastructure, entrepreneurship, development, and so on and so forth. That's the main issue to fight for today.
Okay, well let's zoom in on this word revolt, Gerard Coleman, if we can look at this word and see what's happening. We're looking at a COVID-19 pandemic to have struck, obviously, many parts of the world, Europe no exception, of course, France also. Now, I'm going to ask your reaction to this particular headline, which is very alarming, that came out roughly a week ago. And it said, Europe's governments are losing control of COVID, and because of that, revolt is in the air. And it says that fears of civil unrest are growing as people across the continent no longer trust their leaders to protect them during the crisis. So do you think that maybe the French administration, headed by Macron, is foreseeing something like that perhaps happening? There have been protests in France. We've seen it in Italy, in Naples, where people were just fed up with the lockdowns. And maybe this is a way to make sure that the police is protected, since they are predicting, perhaps, that there's going to be revolts and protests, so we need the police out on the streets. Do you think this may be the case?
Well, they've certainly lost control of the narrative, the COVID-19 narrative. They've lost control of that, I think, because we now have thousands of scientists and doctors speaking out about it. And the consensus they wanted, the absolute consensus about what it is and how dangerous it is, and therefore what they need to do, that has broken down because of alternative media, because of social media. There's been a massive amount of censorship of science during this entire debate, and we've had a monopoly in the media of people linked to pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical interests. And there's a huge pharmaceutical agenda, of course, behind the vaccine, which will make billions of dollars for these big companies. And as your guest said, it is a financial oligarchy, after all, and all these companies are linked to finance markets and high finance. So they do fear a rebellion against that. Of course, they won't be able to impose and make obligatory this vaccine, which is a new type of vaccine, extremely dangerous. It hasn't been tested before. They won't be able to impose that very easily. There's a lot of vaccine skepticism in France. And I don't think that in any case, we don't even know what COVID-19 is, because it's never actually been isolated. So you cannot possibly vaccinate against something you don't really understand. And there is no need to vaccinate against it anyway, because it only kills people who are very, very old, and they usually die of other diseases as well. It isn't really killing people in the way they say it is. It's mostly people who have comorbidities. So I think, what people fear, I would say, rather than this so-called pandemic, is the measures, the harsh measures that infringe on people's liberty. And, you know, if you fear COVID-19, then by all means wear a mask. If you fear COVID-19, then you should have the possibility of staying in your house forever. Why not? Maybe be able to work from home. But people who don't fear it should be allowed to live it normally, and should not be prevented from going about their business, and they should not be forced to wear masks and force the social distance and so on and so forth. And it is these top-down measures, really, which is making life impossible for people. I mean, life has become literally impossible. We now live in a dystopian nightmare. Nothing is open, you're not allowed to do anything, and you're not allowed to say anything. If you have to wear a mask all the time, you can't even have a conversation with people. So this has to stop. You know, this nonsense has to stop. The narrative about COVID-19 is over. It's finished. The so-called pandemic has been over with months, so most of the scientists say. So there is no need to keep this up. But of course, it's not about public health. As I said, the aim of this entire agenda is to move towards a technocracy. And, you know, as Thatcher said, society doesn't exist. Society won't exist in a technocracy. And the family won't exist. Social structures won't exist. Social relations won't exist. And they want people in front of screens and iPhones. They want them connected to the Internet of Things. And it will be the big tech which will decide. And eventually, it will be, you know, people who are savvy in big tech who will be the controllers of society. And, of course, high finance is the overall system we're talking about here.
Okay. When it comes to freedom, however, and rights, Sebastian, you know, the French are known to make their voices heard. They're known for demonstrating. I mean, we've seen the French demonstrate throughout time, and they have demonstrated and they have earned the rights that they have fought for so hard. So, you know, if it comes down to their freedom being restricted, if this is one of the levels that the government is going through that perhaps could lead to other things, other restrictions or oppression, don't you think that you're going to have an outburst of people who are going to come out on the streets? I mean, we've seen it with the Yellow Vests, what they have done. Perhaps we're going to see them again coming out and protesting this law. Do you think that is a possibility?
Of course, it's already, going on. You know, you have demonstration yesterday evening, with a lot of brutality, you know. But from both sides, that's also one of the problems, is that people are becoming violent in both sides because everybody is angry. The policemen, because they have no money, they are not paid, you know. They have to work 24 hours because we have demonstration all the time, and people who are not self-sufficient economically. So you have kind of, with the disintegration of our economy by the financial institution, we have a kind of civil war, mass strike ferment in our country, which is very dangerous. So I think for the lockdown, it's not the same issue. Of course, the COVID, we have a lot of mistakes which have been made. You know, for you take Sweden, for example, they are locking people down now because they wanted to not do it at the beginning, so they have to do it now partially. But so we cannot say that it's fake news all the time, because if you go in the hospital, what I have done in France, you go to the hospital, people are working 24 hours, you know. I mean, at least at the first lockdown, people were working very hard to save life all the time, you know. So the second lockdown was not justified, for sure. But the first one was not a fake news, as we can hear from some scientists. People are really dying. A lot of people have died, not only in France, but in the world. So I think we have to compare what we are saying about this. And I want to say that the problem we have is not this crisis, is the financial disintegration of our system, and with this technocracy, as it was said, to impose financial austerity by all means, with the big pharma, with the GAFAM, with the Silicon Valley, with a mass surveillance system and control of the population. Yes, we have all this problem to fight together.
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guests, political analyst, a member of Solidarity and Progress Party, Sebastian Perimonida from Paris, and journalist and political analyst Geoffroy Coleman from Paris also. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Batakhwi, it's goodbye until next time.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to the program Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. And with me today are two lovely brothers. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. This is Mohsen Naqvi. Thanks for inviting.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Daro from US. Thank you.
So, brothers and sisters, today's topic is very much related to social media. And, you know, we have people today that, and I'm trying to imagine if I did this or not. No, I didn't post any pictures of my kids. But anyway, the topic is that, you know, today people post pictures of their children from the day that they're born until they're pretty much grown-ups on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on you name it. I don't even know what else is out there. Is there anything wrong with this? You know, you're just sharing pictures of your kids. People want to see it. Your family likes it. Any dangers? Anything wrong with this?
Well, definitely it's not the right thing to do. And the reason for that is, first of all, it's not the choosing the name for your child, because you have to choose the name for your child to call the kid. Because this is your name. You have to call him, refer him to something. So you have to choose a name, and you have obligation as Islamically to choose the proper name for him or her. What it comes to the society is that you dealing with the innocent individual in the same way you don't have no right to harm the innocent individual, innocent kid. So you cannot go and slap the infant. You cannot torture the kid.
Are you saying posting a picture is like slapping your kid?
Again, goes back to the topic of dignity. So each individual has dignity, and Allah gives the right and dignity to that individual kid, the infant that grows up until he has the free will. He can distinguish between the right and wrong. Then the burden is from your shoulder to his, to himself.
Right.
So until that time, you're responsible to protect and provide the kid as an best individual in the society. And again, as a character for Islamic religion.
Posting a picture of your kid, how is that related to what you're seeing? How is that harming the kid?
Well, there is a sickness and disease. So the people are like looking to hunt for children and taking advantage of children. So especially with this time of technology. So if you're exposing yourself, you putting your own kid as a target for these wolves to come and prey on your kid.
I think one thing you said that, you know, that the kids don't really have a choice in this, right? The parents are making their choices for them. So in a way, you're taking away the control from the kid. The child doesn't have any choice in what's being posted online, right, about themselves. So do you think also that this is a huge danger? Do you see any benefits to it? You know, what are your thoughts?
Obviously, there is a danger in this, and obviously, as brother has mentioned, every single soul, every single human being has a respect and dignity, and we should respect them in the way obviously they are, and we should let them make their own respect. This way, obviously, when you're taking a choice from a kid, from a child who's been born from the first day you're taking his pictures till the maybe the earlier age, obviously you are not leaving anything for them. Even they cannot freely move in the society, because, you know, we have seen this, that for example the kids who are working in the on the TV shows, for example, or the media, and they become a famous face, even when they're in the school they cannot learn things properly. Their all intentions are towards to gain the the popularity, for example, or become a celebrity for themselves. Even in the schools, they're not obviously studying properly. In the community, they're not living the way they should. They're not very free. Even when they are playing, they should be very much careful, because people know them. So you're taking their freedom from them by doing this.
But what's the harm, though, of posting
a picture? Well, the harm is when you take the freedom of the kids, they cannot obviously develop their thinking. You can say like the they cannot develop their brain the way they should.
Because they're taking a picture and posting on the media?
No, it's because they become a famous.
What you're saying
is it's due to their popularity. If they become a famous personality, social media person, obviously wherever they go, everyone is watching them.
I see.
That's from this point of view. The other point of view is, the question is, why you want to post your kid's picture on the social media? What's the point? We usually share the pictures with our parents, for example, or their uncles or aunts, or maybe the close relatives, the grandparents, who wants to see, and they're living far. This media is helping us because we are here, our parents are back home. This is something else. But when you're even on the Facebook, we have seen that the people are making friends, even those who they don't know, who are not, who they don't aware of. Because Facebook was a mean to join the friends.
Even if let's say you share your pictures only with your friends and relatives, someone might argue that, you know, I'm only sharing it with only my friends and relatives. It's not. The fact is, as soon as you post that picture, it's gone. Like, you do not have control over it, right? Even if it's being posted with privacy settings on high, once it's on the internet, it's being stored in some server and someone can get it back. I think we should realize it's out of your control once it's online.
Two approaches. One is, if you share it with your family members with the security codes or whatever it is somewhere on the server. That's fine. But whoever wants this information, he goes after this information.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's one thing.
That's one thing. The other thing is, you're just publicly showing this picture, and it's available for everyone. Right. This is not good. This is not right thing. Obviously, on the internet, my pictures might be there. My passport copies, maybe I emailed to someone, my CV, my personal information, everything is on the internet. Right. We have these informations on the internet. But posting all these things publicly and showing them to the general public, this is not good. And the main reason is why we are opposing it is because we did not find any good reason for posting the pictures publicly on the social media, because none of these have a logical, you can say, like, answer for this, that why they are posting this for the general public. Yeah. What's the use of this?
The brother mentioned one thing. He mentioned about how there's people, you know, pedophiles. Something I think people don't know is a lot of these pictures that parents post, they are taken down and they're put on child websites, right? So that is a huge danger, I would say, for kids, if nothing else, is that your child's pictures may be put on child websites. And for me, that is a very, very scary kind of thought. But apart from that, brother, these pictures and the way they're being portrayed, kids are being portrayed on the media by the parents, it can affect their personality, right? It can affect, like, their future. It can affect their career. It can affect their marriage. Would you agree with that? And maybe elaborate on how it can impact a person's future life.
Definitely, as brother mentioned, it influences their future in the way that, like, for example, if you've been represented digitally, now you have to keep representing yourself digitally, in the sense that your character starts digitally, and you become a, like, digital person. So you will lose the sense of reality. Like, you will lose the sense of reality. Who am I in the society? So you get lost. You will get lost, definitely. Like, that's why you see, like, people get addicted, even the people born in reality, like our generations, and we get introduced to the technology. Sometimes we see ourselves, our generation, our people, they're like, we are so involved in the technology, we lose the sense of reality. Now you imagine you start with technology. That's why you see in the streets, there's no more kids. No more kids are playing. Everybody's in the digital world, front of the computer games. So their mind is engaged. Their mind is engaged and they forgot about their body. And that's what I think, so the New World Order, that they want to make the humans as a lamb, as a sheep. That's the definition of Dajjalism. The Dajjalic system, the satanic system, wants you to influence you inside the homes. I remember, like, my mom said when the TV first came, my grandfather said, this is the magic box. Because they didn't see the technology before. So when they saw that technology, they understood there is something from outside, from this box, that can influence them. And that was the magic box. And now with this technology, we don't want... See, it's like you're protecting your food, right? When you buy go to shopping and buy the food, you come home, you don't leave your food outside. You organize it, you wash it, the corona and things, you clean it, and you put it back in the fridge. Because you know in the fridge is protected. you don't take the eggs and the meat and open your safe and put it in the safe. Mm. So each compartment has its own object that has to be compartmentalized inside of it. So it's the same thing with information. So you don't want to expose yourself from the beginning of your childhood.
Got it. Do you think that...
And the question is, does the child want this by himself?
Well, they don't have a choice in it, right? Sorry. Yeah.
So that's the thing, that the parents are basically overruling, or they're taking the rights of their kids.
So would you say this is a kind of an oppression that parents are then doing on their kids?
Well, I think the human rights should work on this. The human rights organization,
they should
make a new rights for the kids' right, that do not post your kids' pictures on the social media because it will harm them in the future. Right.
And, you know, the brother mentioned Islam has put a duty upon us for choosing a good name for the child, you know, and helping the upbringing. And I think you guys, we are agreeing that posting these pictures is kind of going against that. You know, it's going against good upbringing off that child. One thing that I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but a lot of times, you know, when kids come into high school, right, other kids that are trying to bully them, they can use these pictures off their kids.
They
right?
do.
They do? Do you know about this?
They do, obviously, on the media. We had some of the examples that the kids who knew or who have the pictures, even their family pictures, obviously the kid is not, he's not alone. For example, he has a picture with his sister or with mother. And then tomorrow in the class, if they're in grade 3 or 4, the other friends are there, they're bullying because of these pictures. And we have seen such, we can say, like the stories coming up in the newspaper, that such things has happened and it had a bad result on the children and obviously on the environment of the school. So these things are affecting. So we need to really think about it seriously, that these things are not the things that we should do. And this is not ethically, if you think socially, if you think, I don't know, according to any perspective, this is not allowed in any case to do such an act.
Yeah, I would even, you know, we're talking about children's pictures. I try not to even post pictures of any one of my family members online. In fact, I mean, I do take pictures of my kids, but at the back of my mind, I know that as soon as I take that picture, even if I'm not sharing it, there's still a danger that someone can get into my phone, you know, and still get these pictures. Because sometimes they get, you know, uploaded onto the cloud, right? They go onto Google Drive and they're being saved online. So I worry, even from that point of view, that even if they're not being shared, they could still get into the wrong hands.
There's a lot of people that know something about the pictures. It's very interesting. The digital pictures, they have metadata. Mm-hmm. So in the metadata, there's a geotag. So in the top of this metadata, whatever you took the picture, it will record the location. If your GPS is active and you give permission to your camera, it will tell you the location. So even that you put your picture in somebody's server or somewhere, it doesn't know your information. They can say what time this picture has been taken and what was the location and what time. So this by itself, it shows the record of your type of your behavior and living. And the behavior of by the living by itself is harmful. For example, again, going back to the same topic of the putting your pictures, your kid's picture in the internet. You're putting a kid's picture in the internet and somebody get access to the location, they will know where you live. Now they can come and kidnap your kid. And who's going to be responsible? You are responsible because you are in charge of protecting your child.
Right, right. Yeah, you can be... Yeah, exactly. The pictures can be used to track you down, to threaten you, or to bully you. So just going to finish off by saying, please don't post pictures of your kids on social media.
If
that hasn't become clear now, I hope it has become clear. So please be careful out there in the digital world. It's definitely not safe as people may think. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Back to Reality. Please continue listening to IRIB English Radio. Take care. Fi amanillah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, التي ما رايزك لا تسي دايلايتك وانسى
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Round the world with reporters.
The latest challenges in the Muslim world. This is the main theme of this gathering, attended by political activists. On top of the conference's agenda was the French government's recent blasphemy to Prophet Muhammad, which triggered worldwide condemnation from Muslims and religious leaders.
Insulting the Prophet of Islam is tantamount to blasphemy against all other religions. The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. Religions don't have any issues with each other. As a Jewish scholar, I believe what the French president said against Islam is unacceptable. He has ignored the sentiments of around 2 billion people.
Delegates also condemned Sudan, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates for their normalization of ties with Israel. Last month, Sudan became the fifth Muslim country after Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, and Jordan to establish diplomatic ties with Israel. Delegates at the conference called it a strategic folly and a backstabbing of Palestinians, who have been suffering under more than 7 decades of Israel's occupation.
Those treacherous regimes have never cared about the interests of Muslims. They only seek to consolidate their foothold as rulers. I'm sure that the people of Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan do not share the stance of their regimes toward Israel. Muslims will never recognize Israel and its occupation of Palestine.
Although the Arab-Israeli détente infuriated the Muslim world, activists say it should not come as a surprise and is solely a revelation of their long-standing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power balance.
Experts here find the root cause of regional crises in lack of coordination and a growing chasm between regional states. They say external players such as the U.S. never want this gap to be bridged, since such a division has long been a chance for them to serve their interests in the region. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an official visit to Afghanistan, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh is seeking to boost ties between Kabul and Tehran via expanding mutual cooperation, mainly in terms of peace and security.
Security of Afghanistan is of a high priority. We think that the security of two nations, Iran and Afghanistan, are very much connected to each other. So we think that through collaboration, through cooperation, we have to be able to secure a stable situation in Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman comes as many here believe Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and that is why players like Iran are struggling to keep their role in the country's peace and security.
Afghanistan is entering a new phase, and all regional players have developed new plans in line with their own interests. For instance, Daesh is replacing the Taliban in Afghanistan. The visit of Iran's foreign ministry spokesman to Kabul proves Iran's effort to expand its role in Afghanistan's security.
The visit of Iran's delegation comes as Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan visited Kabul last week.
The recent political trips of Afghanistan's eastern and western neighbors to Kabul are a proof of importance of the country to them. That is especially at a time when insecurity is on the rise and negotiations are underway between the Afghan government and the Taliban to bring a lasting peace to the war-torn nation. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A debate on fundamental rights in the EU has just concluded in the European Parliament. COVID-19 lockdowns and reduced access to services due to the pandemic have apparently made the elderly more vulnerable, and other groups too.
Women, children in poverty, and people with disabilities.
The 27-nation bloc's asylum system was castigated during the debate.
We have migrants left to rot and fester in camps, while boats of pregnant women and children are pushed out to sea by state forces in Greece. We have migrants raped with the branches of trees by state forces in Croatia. We have Muslims hounded in France.
It's claimed the EU's attitude towards refugees is facilitating abuses both within the bloc and in neighbouring countries.
Greece, Turkey, Poland, Belarus, Spain, Morocco, Hungary, Serbia, and in some countries, Croatia, they even face torture, humiliation, and sexual abuse.
Governments in EU nations, such as Czech Republic and Hungary, are fueling Islamophobia by the way they are dealing with the refugee crisis, according to experts.
They've sought to interpret that crisis as a one of Muslim invasion. And government narratives, when they're deployed in that way, can be very strong.
Other fundamental rights abuses in the EU are also being highlighted. Spanish authorities are criticised for imprisoning activists in Catalonia.
We spend all our time asking Hungary and Poland to act like genuine democratic states, but we don't do anything on Spain. Without civil and political rights, the European project is done for.
Some lawmakers accuse the EU of hypocrisy in terms of how it tries to export its values. Let's just take one example, cozying up to Israel and Saudi Arabia, which have appalling human rights records, while at the same time imposing really tough sanctions against countries such as Russia and Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 15,000 COVID-19 infections and over 65 deaths, mostly since late August. Since Thursday, around 3,000 infections were detected in the impoverished enclave. Hospitals in Gaza currently have less than 100 ICU beds and ventilators for nearly 2 million inhabitants. 80% of ventilators for coronavirus patients have already been taken up. The World Health Organization cautioned that within a week, the health system in Gaza may become unable to care for critical cases.
The situation is becoming extremely dangerous in Gaza amid rapid increase of coronavirus infections, and people here will continue to suffer. The health sector is already fragile and in a very bad shape because of the Israeli blockade. The health system will soon be unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and other health needs.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's health system and almost paralyzed its ability to provide health services by refusing to allow in vital medical equipment amid the apathy of the international community. Unfortunately, some Arab regimes are normalizing ties with Israel and encouraging it to perpetrate more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Local authorities have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is one of the main reasons why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, especially on the health system. The health system is struggling with the logistics, lack of medical equipment, as well as testing kits for the virus and hospital ventilators to keep patients alive.
Rights groups warn that Gaza is facing a catastrophic situation under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Cafes, restaurants in Catalonia are back in business after a prolonged coronavirus shutdown that impacted thousands of businesses, pushing angry workers out on the streets in protest. Following a sustained decrease in the daily number of COVID-19 cases, the regional government scrambled to improve a plan to reopen the economy unveiled last week by increasing operating hours and adding concert halls to the list of businesses that can reopen.
We are very happy to be back to work and hope this is the last time we shut down because it will be the end for our business. I cried every day when I was out of work because I have a family to feed. We are worried. We can't fail this time.
Under the new guidelines, food service businesses are able to operate indoors at 30% occupancy, while they can serve at full capacity on terraces, provided they keep a 2-meter distance between tables. The 4-phase reopening is expected to last 2 months, with a gradual lifting of restrictions on movement inside of the Spanish northeastern region. A 10 p.m. curfew will stay in place for several weeks as the situation in hospitals and intensive care units remains critical. Meanwhile, authorities have launched massive antigen testing campaigns across the region in a bid to control the spread of the virus.
The antigen rapid test detects the COVID-19 virus using a nasal swab. It offers a highly reliable result within 15 minutes, and it is one of the most cost-effective tests on the market right now.
Although test sensitivity for rapid antigen testing is generally lower than for the standard PCR, authorities are pushing for their deployment, arguing they could be useful in detecting highly infectious people. With a population of 7.5 million, Catalonia has registered over 300,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 15,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic.
The reopening of the economy in Catalonia is fraught with its fair share of risk and reward for everyone involved. It will take at least 2 weeks to find out if the second shot at the virus was successful. The stakes for the food service, hospitality, entertainment, and sports industries have never been higher. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Some 120 kilometers from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir, lies Uri. The line of control that divides Kashmir into two parts and ruled by India and Pakistan runs through this area of Baramulla district of Indian-held Kashmir. After trekking around 10 to 15 minutes, you reach the Smurthal village, which is frequently a target of India-Pakistan animosity. Parviz Ahmed's house was completely destroyed in the recent India-Pakistan face-off, although his family was lucky enough to survive this devastating attack.
This is not new for the people who live near the LOC, but this time it was a rain of artillery. Years of my toil is wasted. I and my family of five are homeless now in this winter. The fire even burned the food stock that I had stocked up for the winter months.
Weeks have passed since the incident. Parvez is still waiting for help and relief work to begin.
We have repeatedly asked the government to build bunkers for the people living in this area. The government is not paying attention to our needs.
The Jammu and Kashmir administration is working on a project to construct 44 bunkers for people living along the line of control. They said that another project for building some 250 individual bunkers is underway.
Whenever we go to government officials with a request, they often turn us away. Many times they say, go and seek help from Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Whatever is being said about help and relief is a media stunt, a part of which might reach us but too late.
For decades, Kashmiris have been bearing the brunt of India-Pakistan animosity. The two countries have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir, which they rule in parts but claim in its entirety. Kashmir has lost tens of thousands of people after the armed struggle against Indian rule began in 1989. India accuses Pakistan of training and sending fighters into Indian side of Kashmir, something Pakistan denies but says it only supports the idea of free and unified Kashmir, politically and diplomatically. The question that remains is how long will Parvez and many others like Parvez wait for government's assistance? Can they survive this harsh winter without a proper shelter? And how long will it take the world to stand for the resolution of this long-pending dispute without further destruction? Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
As the European Council is set to convene in December to discuss the tensions with Turkey, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called for dialogue, but warned the EU not to become a tool for enmities during escalating tensions over the Eastern Mediterranean. In his latest statement on Turkey-EU ties, Erdogan said Turkey sees its future in Europe and mentioned Turkey's post-pandemic plans to improve judicial infrastructure and strengthen the economy and other reforms.
We see ourselves as an inseparable part of Europe, with which we share 600 years of historical bonds. We are calling on the EU to create a closer bond with us, to keep the promise of full membership for Turkey. We see ourselves in Europe, not anywhere else. We aim to build our future with Europe.
Observers, however, say Turkey does not stand any chance to become an EU member despite all negotiations.
In my opinion, the EU does not see Turkey either as a partner or a possible member of the bloc. For the EU, Turkey is only a trade ally. This means that neither now or in future, Turkey will not get closer to becoming an EU member.
Earlier this week, the EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, said Turkey isn't sending positive signals and needs to change its attitude fundamentally regarding the hydrocarbon dispute with EU members Greece and Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea. European leaders say they will watch for Turkey's steps in the next couple of weeks before discussing any potential sanctions in their upcoming summit. Turkey is still a candidate to become an EU member. The bloc decided to effectively freeze accession talks in June 2018 over disagreements on accession terms. Many here are pessimistic about the future of accession talks, despite Ankara's ongoing efforts to meet the EU's demands. Meanwhile, some economists even warn that the accession could harm Turkey's economy. Prashant Saglam, Istanbul.
Israel launched airstrikes in the early hours of Sunday on the Gaza Strip, causing damage to surrounding areas, but no casualties reported. Israel claims the airstrikes targeted Hamas positions and came in response to a rocket fired from Gaza toward the southern city of Ashkelon, the second time in 2 weeks.
Israel is not committed to its responsibilities, refusing to allow in the required ventilators for the enclave amid the coronavirus pandemic. The resistance front preserves the right to give a crushing response to those violations.
The Palestinian groups say they will continue their resistance as long as Israel is imposing its crippling blockade over the impoverished enclave, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic and the shortage of medical equipment and ventilators.
It is the resistance movement's duty to defend Palestinians against the Israeli aggression under any condition. Israel should be held accountable for the deterioration of the Palestinians' lives. This is a crime against Gazans.
Observers say Israel's refusal to meet the basic needs of Palestinians increases the possibility of further escalation.
The ongoing conflict comes as a result of Israel's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip over the past 14 years. Palestinians won't remain silent. Through strikes like the recent ones, Israel is seeking to cover up its internal problems.
Israel has been conducting similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months.
The resistance groups here stress they are ready for any possible escalation, and their resistance will go on until the crippling siege on the Gaza Strip is broken. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
With almost 100,000 children under the age of 5 at risk of dying, Yemen slides into a dire situation. Here lies the 9-month-old Munir struggling to survive a severe malnutrition.
This is my son Munir. We've been here for a week. We want to treat him for malnutrition, and God helps us. We're resisting this savage war.
The ongoing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia has brought a severe famine described by the UN as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
There is an increase in malnutrition cases. Yemeni children are suffering from malnutrition in all governorates, and we receive 50 to 60 cases per day. There is a shortage of medical equipment like CT scanners.
The UN's former humanitarian coordinator for Yemen described the country's food security status as catastrophic. Now, a UN analysis shows that the coronavirus pandemic, economic problems, and the war have pushed malnutrition the highest levels in some parts of the country. According to the UN study, malnutrition has risen 15% among children under the age of 5 this year.
We condemn and denounce the continued international silence about the blockade imposed on Yemen and the failure to take any measures against the Saudi coalition, which has exacerbated human suffering, especially for children.
Millions of children in Yemen could be pushed out of starvation by the end of the year, as the humanitarian crisis is compounded by the ongoing war and the blockade, along with the pressure of funding shortage as the world grapples with the coronavirus pandemic. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A large number of people turned up in the garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistani capital Islamabad. These angry youngsters were outraged against India over its alleged unending brutalities against Muslims in disputed Kashmir region. So were they resentful against Israel for suppressing Muslims in the occupied Palestine.
Equally, these protesters are angry with the rulers of many Arab states over their alleged collaboration with India and particularly with Israel in strengthening their illegal hold of territories belonging to the Muslims. But it seems for these protesters, there is a leadership vacuum in the Muslim world.
This protest was organized by Youth Parliament, an organization of students of colleges and universities from all over Pakistan. They have been campaigning to forge greater unity among Muslims across their racial and sectarian profiling and regions. With greater unity among the ranks and files of Muslims, these students are struggling to bring an end to the atrocities being committed against Muslims by reviving the true spirit of Muslim nationhood all over the Islamic world.
We will never accept Israel. They are bombarding on the small children in the Palestine. They are Muslims. We are standing with them and they are looking for the Pakistan, that they should come for the help for the Palestine.
The protesters sounded disappointed with the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who won last general elections partially with the pledge to pursue Muslim causes. Muslim causes in the world appears to be what matters to the common people in Pakistan. The lingering public resentment against France over repeated publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of Islam is yet another cause these students have been fighting for. This protest has followed gathering of millions of people on the streets of eastern city of Lahore a few days ago. Such a huge crowd emerged to attend the funeral of Khadim Hussain Rizvi, a religious and political leader who through his sustained protest forced Prime Minister Imran Khan last week to ink an agreement with his government to expel French ambassador and officially boycott French products in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Rawalpindi.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio. And our info is based on tradition. Today, we are going to continue the discussion on modesty. And we have in our studio Sister Salma Khalfan, who is in fact my aunt. Welcome to the program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over. Inshallah, we will have a nice discussion about women, get to know each other better also in the process.
Inshallah. Thank you so much. So in our previous program, we talked about hijab and modesty and chastity, that it roots from modesty, and how modesty in reality has to, if implemented by even men and women, it could change and preserve this community and society of ours, and it can make it flourish. It can make our lives, our relations with everybody, with our spouses, all much better. So, alhamdulillah, we had a very fruitful discussion. We hope that you can add more onto this.
I would like to cite some traditions on the importance of this issue, that is the covering, the hijab and the modesty all in all, that in some narrations, modesty is regarded as the whole of religion.
Subhanallah.
Yeah, the whole of religion. It is narrated from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, who said modesty is the whole of the religion.
Wow.
Because if you go and see modesty, and the character of modesty is to actually hide the things not to be seen by others.
Yeah.
That is only your right.
Very
or
true.
The people who share that mahramiyat with you, your mahram, that nearness with you, the blood relatives.
Yeah, yeah.
Who are allowed only. Not even all blood relatives. Some blood
of
relatives,
them.
Yeah. Like we know cousins are not.